I'm a alcoholic. I probably came in here into Alcoholics Anonymous for the wrong reason, because I got scared because my drinking became inconvenient. And what did that mean? Well, the first thing I learned in I caught and I learned and I never forgot was somebody was talking about self-medicating. I didn't know what that meant, but I knew that was important. And I found out years later that's what I was doing. I was controlled drinking for the first 20 years of it, and then I was drinking like you guys. And that's when I got scared. I got out of my comfort zone. I started looking around for AA because I didn't know anything about it. I never got caught for anything. Never been in jail. I'm one of those people. So I found a lady that had an AA directory in her purse, and she led me to my first AA meeting, which was in Temple City, California, in Los Angeles. I stayed there for about 2.5 years, and I got there early. Like I, people don't have self-esteem, do they? Always show up early. So I'm sitting there, and I'm looking at the steps and the traditions, and I almost walked up because of all the God that was written on both of those things. And I read them again to make sure that I actually counted it, because that's what I do. I count stuff. So anyway, I talked myself into staying because I came there on my own power because I wanted to find out how to stop drinking. I hadn't talked to anybody yet. So I told myself, I'll talk to somebody, then I'll leave. So we got into the meeting, and I got sort of busy, and I introduced myself as a newcomer, and I also told them I didn't believe in God. And I think back about this, that the only reason I had anything against those people is that there was no plan B for the person who didn't believe in God. It was their way or whatever you're gonna do, you can't do it in here. And so I stayed there, and for about 2.5 years, either I got sober in spite of them or because of them. I think it's because I stuck around for the meetings. And I found out that's where the magic works. And I tell people I don't know how it works, but that's how it does. Just talking back and forth to each other. And I went to a lot of coffee, mostly Denny's, because they're open 24 hours a day. I don't think they even have locks or doors. So there was probably about six or seven newcomers. They're all about the same type of sobriety. And we kind of hung out together. And it worked. Some of us, one of us went for a whole year, and she decided she didn't want to be sober anymore. So one of the guys in the program took her to the liquor store, and she bought her booze, and she went out. I kind of maintained a fellowship with her for a while, and I don't know. It's just. Anyway, she went away. I hope she's still alive. This stuff works. So, okay, now I'm going to meetings. And I was sneaking out of the house to do it. And I told my wife when she caught me, she wanted to know where I was going at 7 o'clock at night. And I told her I was going to an AA meeting. And she didn't particularly impress one way or the other with it. So I just kept on going. So and then it was okay for me to go out and hang around with strange people. Oh, they were very, very pushy about getting a higher power, getting a sponsor, getting a big book. I didn't want to buy one of those because I already knew what was in it by looking at the steps. So I bought a big book. And the more I read the big book, the more I got confused about doing the steps. I needed somebody to help me. So I got what they refer to as a sponsor, but I got somebody to interpret what the hell I'm reading about it and what does that mean on paper. And so I finally did that. It took me about a year to finally finish up my steps because I was really slow because I wasn't a very good student to start with. So that was one of my problems. So anyway, I did the steps. I did the fifth step in my sponsor's backyard, which is a guy I got that was 30 miles away from my home group. And I did that. And that was 38 years ago, I think, something like that. I did that. So anyway, that was over with. So whenever they ask me, how I'm doing the steps, I tell them I did them, I never did get a higher power. I never did take the third step as it's written on the walls. Because I still don't have a higher power. I don't know, because I have too much ego or something. I just don't know. So I look at my sobriety, it's got my fingerprints all over it. So stuff I had to do. So anyway, we started growing up. At least I did. I started dealing with stuff I should have dealt with before. I had an extraordinary job when I was working for the Southern Pacific Railroad, and the job got too much of a job. it was a seniority-based industry, and you know, just being there, you just got the number kept going up. So you kept, you know, all of a sudden I was catching foreman jobs. Now I had a locomotive, three guys working with me, you know, and I'm on the main line. I don't know none of this kind of shit. So I got scared. So in my typical way of doing stuff, I just didn't pick up the phone anymore. I didn't tell them I didn't work there anymore. I just stopped showing up. And so the union caught me and he said, well, if you got to quit, you got to tell them. So I wrote him a letter and I did that. And about a year and a half later, I was trying to get the job back. And they wanted me to be a diesel mechanic. I didn't know anything about diesels until we worked with them. So I turned that down, which is probably a bad idea. Anyway, so that was the first mistake I made when I was drinking. And it was stupid. Now, as an adult, I'd love to have had the opportunity just to have it, just to do it. You know, it'd be a fun thing to do. But that's gone. Even the railroad itself is gone. And the place where it was is all gone. It seems like everything in my past sort of disappears. It's not like I don't go back and hang around the old company, you know, the old people. They're just all gone. And now I'm so old, they literally have passed away. So it's one of the benefits of stop drinking. You know, you don't die so quick. So anyway. My wife wanted a divorce about 6 months into my program. And I just, all I could, you know, do is just agree with her. You know, she wanted it, she wanted out. I'm not going to fight it. And so she was going to go away with this architectural engineer. And they had it all figured out. She was going to marry this guy, so there was going to be no alimony. The kids are going to be out of the country for at least a minimum 5 years, which means that they'll be able to see a team when they come back. So there wouldn't be any child support. And this guy's suggestion was, why don't you just quick deed the house over to me? And just basically, you know, the house is my responsibility. Well, that didn't work out because by the end of the first year of my program, she didn't want to get a divorce. And the way I look at it, if that would have happened as they had planned, I'd still be stuck in East Los Angeles. And I can't see that as any kind of a future. So it's just amazing the stuff that just worked in its way into my life. And we went down that road instead of the other one. So anyway, like I was talking to you before, I was heavily into guns. I belonged to five different gun clubs. I was invited to shoot for the U.S. government and to shoot in foreign countries. All kinds of crazy stuff I was involved with. And then I started going to rifle matches sober, and I couldn't drink it myself anymore. And then it dawned on me, those had to go. And I couldn't understand why. I was taking it at the meetings like, oh, that's stupid. The guy next to me is trying to figure out where he's sleeping. I'm trying to, you know, why do I want to get rid of my gun collection? It took me 30 years to build. That's not the place. So anyway, I gave myself permission. I got rid of the guns. We put that money into a second house after the divorce wasn't going to happen after all. So that's how we wound up with a mountain house in the mountains. So that's the first thing we did in sobriety. So that was great. It was like both of us felt like we were now adults. We had some place to go on the weekends like other people did. So my kid, I couldn't keep out of jail. And he was had about 5 years. They threw him out of school at 13 because he had marijuana. So he couldn't go back to school. So he got his GED in the Orange County Jail. That's finally what he did. He got himself in trouble with the Southern Pacific Railroad. And the only reason I bring this up because it affected everything. Because we have two houses now. And he was 18 and 9 months. So we weren't past 17 and 9 months. He wasn't quite 18. And so the Southern Pacific Railroad, they caught him. And what he did, he ruined the sight cages on the locomotive's fuel cells, which each one of those locomotives hold 8,500 gallons of diesel fuel. So three of those things, and 27,000 gallons of diesel fuel laying in the dirt. And he got away with that one, but he went back the next day. And one of the diesels, one of the engines was sitting in a pool of this oil. And so for some reason, he decided to set it on fire, and it did. And it got so bad, the LA fire department couldn't put it out. I couldn't get close enough to it because it kept exploding and stuff. So anyway, he ruined that locomotive. And I remember when I was working for that company, what those things cost is $1,125,000 a piece. And that one's history. So I went down there and I'm talking to the head of the police department for the railroad, for the LA division. And he's asking me why I was down there. I told him because my kid just burnt this thing. So I'm taking pictures of it. I was so afraid that because of the railroad and the attitude that they were taking about it, that we're going to lose the house we were living in and the house that we just bought. I'm thinking, this is a hell of a thing. You know, it's like the first year and a half of sobriety. This sucks. Yeah. So anyway, he did the magic thing. He said, I did it. And then they gave him 3 years and 3 months. That's how much time he was supposed to be locked up somewhere. And so after 3 months, when he turned 18, they threw him out of the place. So that changed everything. So we decided, I quit the family business. My wife quit the practice she was at. We sold the house and we moved up to the house in the mountains. So we lived up there for the next 10 years. This one more road that we just happened to take in sobriety. And it was marvelous. It's four seasons. My wife didn't know the sky was actually blue. She thought it was gray, you know, because she never got away. So now we are. Now she worked in the dental field and she got a job right away. There's 12 dentists up there and she worked for 11 of them those 10 years. Seven of those years, I drove off the mountain and I was 74 miles each way to go back and forth to work. That's after I quit my best job I had in the mountains was making donuts. You know, I'm a trained machinist. I'm making donuts for crying out loud. You didn't even need to speak English to make donuts. So that's gone. I got a job. They hired me on the spot. They wanted me to quit the donut place, and I did that. And I worked there for about a year, and then the donut shop was offered to me if I wanted to take over the whatever the hell that deal was they had. And we said no. So in about 10 years, we finally moved off the mountain, got down on the flatlands. I was 40 miles closer to work, 30 miles away from the actual job itself. And I worked that job for the next 26 years and 19 days. And it was an opportunity for me to practice my skill. They didn't pay for it. They were terrible with their employees about paying them compensation. But I stayed because, I wasn't a supervisor or anything. I was just a card employee, but everybody came to me for stuff. We had 155 people in that place. And they're asked for this functional literate stuff. I thought that was amazing. But I was good at my trade. And then when I left, they'll never replace me. In fact, most of the people that were there when I left is probably gone themselves because it's been 9 years since I've been retired. So we got a house off the mountain because I was falling asleep on that trip going home. I was getting home at 3 o'clock in the morning. And jeepers, I had fallen asleep and I woke up and the car is still moving and I was in a turnout, which is a white spot in the road for taking pictures and stuff. And that happened 2 times. And I didn't know what to do about it because I was out of control. I never drank until a blackout. I never had one of those things. But to me, that's got to be what a blackout is. And that just terrified me. So anyway, we've been looking at houses and stuff, and this lady called. She was selling houses, and we talked to her 2 years before that. She had 7 houses left over out of 77 that she sold. So we went down there, and we bought the house that we lived in for the next 22 years in the city of San Bernardino. 22 years we lived in that place. Anyway, it was such a good bargain that we got it for exactly what it cost them to build it and to buy the property. They didn't make a penny on the damn thing. So now I'm working for this company, Alger Manufacturing. They're still in business. The recession was starting to show up. We were never underwater in our house. And I was thinking about getting, putting more money in a 401k. So I started to collect Social Security. Had all kinds of irons in the fire. It got to the point that we were just pretty much grateful that we still had a job because we thought the company was going to close up. And it didn't. And I had people that worked, the staffers in the office, they're on the second operation of machines for me. They didn't want to let them go, and they didn't have nothing to do, so they got their hands dirty. I was sad. But I stuck to that job until I couldn't stand it anymore because of the financial thing. They didn't give us a raise of any kind for 9 years in a row. And to me, that's like 27% less buying power. You know, for a person who doesn't have self-esteem, all you have is your job. That's kind of like an insult. So 2 months before I quit, they gave a 3% raise across the entire plant. And for me, that was $80 a month before taxes. It's less than $1,000 a year. So I quit on New Year's Eve. That's the last day I worked. They gave me a retirement party and all that kind of stuff, which I didn't want to go to. But I thought about it. I thought, you know what? I have an opportunity to give 155 people a half hour, 10 minute break. So that's the only reason I did that party. And that's what they got. So, you know, didn't make me a hero. They never figured it out. But I got out of there just in time. I worked till I was 71 and a half. You know, I got into this program when I was 40 and a half. So all this stuff happens in sobriety. And I used to hear people when I first came to the program, you know, I did surgery without pain meds. You know, I'm thinking, what's wrong with you? You know, I think back about it. Yeah, all this stuff, you know, with the scared thing about losing the house and everything and go back to ground zero again. All the sobriety. In November the 5th, 2000, my wife had a heart attack that kills 90 out of 100 people. And she died in the emergency room. That's the only reason she didn't die, because she was in the emergency room. And they brought her back. That was 23 years ago. And that's the time when I forgot all about that. When I was living in the mountains, I stopped going to AA meetings. I took the one thing that was bothering me more than anything else I could think of was road rage. It didn't have a name. And I shared it at a meeting, and it fell on deaf ears. And so I didn't figure it was going to be any way out of it by just sharing it, but I knew that was the proper thing to do. I've been hanging on this thing for so long. It was eating me up on the inside. And I walked away. It was one of the buildings at the airport that they couldn't find a real place to have meetings anymore. That's where I was that day. And I thought, well, I'll reverse engineer this thing, because that's kind of what I do for a living. And I figured out what the triggers were, and I started practicing what I'm preaching to myself. And I got it pretty much under control. And then I moved up the mountain. And then I spent, like I said, the next 22 years working and living in San Bernardino. But when I stopped going to meetings, I wasn't mad at the program. I wasn't getting out of the fellowship what I thought I was supposed to get, because of the God issue. It's the only thing I could think of. And so I just, 1 year after another went, and then when I retired, I almost died myself when I got sepsis and pneumonia at the same time. I retired the same year, and we decided to move. And so we moved to where we're at now, is Las Vegas. That's 7 years ago. So I got very depressed. And I think I had a lot to do with the physical exertion of just moving, living in that house for 22 years and being a closet hoarders. We didn't know we were that. I had so much stuff I had to get rid of. So I wound up here. And then I learned in the program that, you know, you should get outside help if you need that kind of stuff. And so I was thinking, I'm not working anymore. I might as well go seek a psychiatrist. So I called the health group I was in, and they set me up to meet with a gatekeeper. And I got past him, and again, I got a real psychiatrist. And so I talked to this guy for a while, maybe 4 or 5 months. I never kept track of it. And I got to my AA story, and I told it to this guy, and he stopped writing. And he says, how come you don't go back to the program? Well, I didn't go there to come back to the program. I come there to deal with the suicide thinking. And so I thought, yeah, why not? So I took a suggestion, and I did. And I went back to the same guy meeting I left all those years before that. But I didn't expect anything different. And they didn't smoke. And I thought that was really a good idea. because I never did smoke. So I spent about the first year just sitting on my hands, just listening and learning. And they'd ask me if I wanted to share once in a while, and I kind of got slow in the sharing. And that's what I told them. So after going into the second year, I started sharing a little bit. I was very cagey and careful about my sharing because they were pretty much, very religious. And I didn't want to, that's how they got sober. I'm not going to insult how they got sober. That's not why anybody goes to meetings. And so I kept my, kind of toned down my stuff. And then this lady came in and she said that she went to a secular meeting. I didn't know what it was. And I asked her where it was. And I found the geographical address of it. And I went there and I went to my first secular meeting. I was 33 years sober at the time. And I didn't know how to share there either because, So anyway, I hung around and I learned, what I could talk about. And we did talk about stuff. And I started counting sobriety on that. We had a table in the middle of the room and chairs that go around the perimeter of the room. 15 people sit at the table. I count 300 years of sobriety twice sitting around that table. There's a lot of people that had God issues, and where were they when I was new? I just didn't know. So anyway, so now I don't have to go to the God-based meetings anymore. I go to regular meetings, secular meetings. And then I was going to a couple of years before the coronavirus showed up. And that kind of knocked the wind out of a lot of stuff. And in the Valley, I think we have like 1,100 meetings a week scattered all over the place. There's like 2.5 million people out here. So, and they do have a drinking problem here. I don't know how anybody gets sober in Vegas because you can buy booze 24 hours a day, any day of the week. There's no limit on what you can buy or when you can buy it. If they got a slot machine, they probably got booze in the place somewhere. So here I am, this kid that doesn't know anybody, don't have any friends. Then because of the new meeting I was going to, I started to meet people. The newcomer had 5 years. There was two of them. And so we looked at ourselves as like some kind of a dinosaur kind of meeting. Because the average sobriety is 35 plus years. So anyway. I stopped going to those secular meetings for two reasons. One was a personality or principle kind of a thing with me at one of the meetings. And because of the car I have, it would cost me $8 in gasoline to go there and $2 for the tradition. So it's like $10 to be uncomfortable on the folding chairs. So I just finally gave up on the folding chairs. That was a deal breaker for me. I suffer from bony butt syndrome, and I can't stand folding chairs, so I don't use it anymore. So, okay, now what? I've been sober a long time. Both of us, my wife retired early because she had that heart attack, and she wanted to collect Social Security before she couldn't. Well, she's still alive. She's 78 years old. And her father died when he was 96 because he broke his neck and nobody could fix it. So he wished himself dead. He'd probably still be alive if it wasn't for that. So he's also living on M&M. So that might be another way of committing suicide. I don't know. But I keep thinking back about my life. We've had everything that we ever needed. We never got all the stuff we wanted. It's the same story people tell themselves when they get honest. Like I said, my wife is still married to me, and my sobriety date's the same as the wedding anniversary because I can remember one over both of them now. And so in this coming January, the 17th, it'll be my 40th year. It'll be my 59th year with her, And that's all I can tell people, about sobriety. Just don't drink and go to meetings. And shit happens. Sometimes it's actually good. Well, I don't know. That's about as I'd be surprised if anybody's still asleep. Now, I never talk about my drunk a lot because I was a boring drinker. I drank by myself. And I had two drinking partners. At night, when I woke up, I never thought about the drink in the middle of the night. I'd be watching Cal Worthington doing his stuff. And the daytime, because of my hours, I'd go home, and it was before the news, so I'm watching Sesame Street while I'm drinking beer in the garage. That was my social event. I'm talking about a boring story. How much more? It's a sad story when you think about it. But I don't know. I've gone to meetings, the neurodiversity meetings. I find those very enlightening. It explains to me why I do what I did when I was a kid and why I was using that self-medicating stuff in the first place. Because I didn't have any questions. I couldn't answer them. I just accepted it as that's the way it was. And after I quit thinking about it, the answer shows up. It's kind of strange how that works. I'm not a writer. I can't spell worth a hill of beans. So I don't take notes. That's the reason that's funny about the paper trail thing. I don't have a paper trail because I just never generated one. So I don't know what time it is, how long I've been talking. I don't know if that's enough time or not. But that's one person, how he got sober. And he's still sober. And I figure if any of those yachts are going to happen, it's going to have to happen pretty soon because I celebrated my 80th birthday. And I thought about that. What have I accomplished in that? My 29,200 days, what did I do? I took my first breath, and I've been doing that on a regular basis for a long time. I got married when I was 22. I got sober when I was 40. Now I'm going to be 80. I am 80. And I gotta have to get serious about life because a lot of people die in their 80s. And that's getting into the range of where my parents died. So I don't think about death anymore. I don't think it's a particularly good idea. But I also didn't, I never, it never dawned on me to call suicide prevention or check back into Alcoholics Anonymous. I guess it was going to work if I let myself do it. One of the things I did, I started going on panels through Ross Neal, which I don't know if it's a state-run, it's awful big. It might be a state-run mental institution. There were the people who survived their suicide attempts. That's where they lock them up and they medicate them, and I don't know when they get out of that place. And I try to share when I go down there, but it's kind of a weird story I got. Hated drinking in bars. I didn't ever want to be 10 foot tall or handsome. I just wanted to be not me. And it worked fine. That scared me. That's why I'm here.